Good evening. Thank you all for coming. Tonight we're going to discuss, sort of in an open forum amongst the four of us, some of the problems that we're encountering in mastering now we've found it as far as the 21st century. We'll just throw the discussions between the four of us. If along the way you feel you'd like to ask a question, something pertinent at that point, please do put your hand up and ask. If we think it fits in with the direction we're going, we'll answer it. If it's something we're going to cover later on, I'll probably tell you to wait and be patient. And if not, we'll try and help and answer it. So let me introduce you to the panel first of all. On my left is Ray Staff. Ray is sort of godfather of mastering and mastering engineers in this country, starting many years back at Trident. Building both his and their reputation as an independent centre of technical excellence. Following their closure, Ray went to work at The Exchange before leaving to head mastering at Sony Whitfield Street. He then moved off to the top of the world in Centrepoint with Alchemy, and more recently is to be found heading the team at Air Mastering in Hampstead. David Woolley, on my right, has worked in audio for for more than 25 years, starting out in the late 70s as a junior house engineer at Air Studios. Through the 80s, he developed early digital audio studios at Trillion and later with Double Vision, moving on to Telecine Cell. By the mid-90s, he set up his own business, ThornQuest, focusing on personal service. He's involved in mixing, mastering, editing, audio and music for broadcast and sell-through in every description, every format. Mazen Murad, on my far right, after studying music production at Australian Film, Television and Radio School, Mazen began his professional career
EMI.
At 301. EMI 301 in Sydney. After a period of recording and mixing, it led him into a career as a mastering engineer. In 2001, he moved to 301 in Cologne, a newly established mastering facility. And after 3 years in Germany, he left to join Whitfield Street Studios. Then in 2005, he joined Metropolis Mastering. Since working there, he's worked with a wide range of artists. And in particular, he's been helping in repurposing various classic performances of jazz, rock and pop musicians from the 50s and 60s, and love it or hate it, he's involved in turning stuff from mono into stereo and surround. We're not going to debate the reasons for doing that. It's purely a commercial thing, but he's very successful at producing something that sounds acceptable at all levels. So that leaves me. I work at Metropolis. I've been in the business about 30 years. I started at the BBC in engineering. I then moved to the townhouse and got heavily involved in mastering there. And then 17 years ago, helped set up Metropolis Mastering, where I've remained ever since, being a sort of technical head. Trying, as often as not, trying to sort things out and make it all work. Which leads us on to some of the topics we've picked for this evening. First, and they're in no particular order, but this is something that we've heard for a long, long time. People always refer to the sound is out of sync. When was the last time we actually heard somebody say the pictures are out of sync? It's always assumed it's the sound. There's a number of reasons why it is no longer the sound. For the last 30 odd years, recording studios have been extremely good, even in the days of analogue, at locking two tape machines together and keeping them locked substantially better than video machines were ever locked together. And certainly the sound was locked to video back in the days of analogue. We have a number of reasons why nowadays the pictures are repeatedly turning up out of sync, and indeed still why some of the sound is remaining out of sync. I'm going to waffle for a little bit more on this, but and then I'm going to hand over to David to talk about some certain aspects of this and then throw it open amongst us. But one of the things that's happening nowadays, we've all the video world's moved happily forward to using HD cameras. And compared to an SD camera, an HD camera takes one more frame to produce the picture as a rule of thumb. If you've then got an SD camera that's working wireless, transmitting back to, let's say, a truck at a venue recording a concert, that's one additional frame of delay. If, let's say, there's still a nice old SD standard definition camera sitting at the back of the venue doing a wide shot of the stage, that's effectively, you know, if we say that's our datum, then the HD camera is one frame behind that, the HD wireless camera is two frames behind that. We are always assuming that, of course, the director in post-production has taken a lot of care in resyncing all his camera feeds. But assumption isn't always the way it goes. And sometimes, of course, this isn't realised until the very last minute when the client actually comes back and goes, but your sound's out of sync. And you go, well, wait for the shot change and it'll be back in sync because your cameras are out of sync. There are many other reasons why further down line these things will go out of sync. Not least, there's a propensity to shoot on not less necessarily inferior cameras, but on a lot of handheld cameras, SLR type cameras, that there's not necessarily always the attention to slating them or relying that the time code is accurate. Moving on from that, David's got some issues. Sorry, there's one other thing I was going to do first. When we come to actually work with HD cam machines, which are the HD cam SR is very much the standard now for multi-channel audio and stereo. It'll handle 12 channels of audio. There are many, many ways you can end up with that audio out of sync. It has possibly the most complicated menu set we've ever seen. In moving on from that, we then have to consider using something like Dolby E. And I'm going to hand over to David at this point for a moment.
To talk about?
Well, let's talk about Dolby E and a bit about HD cam and some of the problems that we can fall into.
Yeah, good evening. Things seem to get more and more complicated with latencies of the equipment as we progress through the different generations of digital equipment. The digital Betacam, which is a standard definition format, was fairly straightforward, I think, and seemed to be a logical progression from the analog Betacam machines. And the lower specification HD cam decks seem to be fairly straightforward as well, that they're progressing on from digital Betacam. And don't really present too many issues with latency of the signals passing through. But what's giving me big headaches and uncertainties is in post-production what's happening inside the HDCam SR decks. And these are the sort of flagship highest video resolution machines. They've got a bigger colour range on them, which is why the video editors and why the broadcasters like them and prefer them over HD cam format. But I suppose as a as a consequence of them having that much higher bandwidth and having the capability to run two streams of video on certain specialised HD cam machines, and because they can operate at all the different frame rates and television standards, they become quite complicated in the options and permutations that you can operate them on. And from a user's perspective, my feeling is that that's come down to the lowest common denominator, that at each turn where a complication arose, the designers had to bow to pressure, and they just seemed to put more and more little fudge factors on how the machines can be operated. So going back up a level, I think it takes something in the region of 150, 160 milliseconds for a signal to pass through these machines to actually to move from the back panel of the machine before it's actually printed onto the tape. And I think it takes about another 150 milliseconds for the signal to come off the tape through the electronics and before it hits the back panel of the machine. Which I think then leads on through these layers of complexity, in that, for example, if you're attempting to do an insert into an existing tape, for example, doing an audio layback onto the tape, then it's going to take your audio, let's call it four frames, to get from the back panel onto the tape, and it's also taking four frames for the video to get off the tape and onto the back panel so that you're seeing it. So because the numbers are so large in that, you need to allow the machine to take care of all of that timing and only ever really look at the output of the machine. So that you need to be watching your watching the video off the output of the machine, and also listening to your audio that you're laying back onto the machine after it's been through and back out again. And this that on the face of it sounds fine, that there is a way around the problems of having such a large latency in the process of the processing of the machine, that you can say, well, okay, I'll just listen to the world, whatever it is, four frames after it happened, and just look and listen to the output of the machine. And my VU meter's on what's coming off my playing machine that's making the sound are happening four frames in advance of what I'm hearing. And when I want to press cut on a channel of audio or something, I have to press it four frames before. But anyway, that's one thing. You learn to live with that. But of course, there are bear traps involved with that, because if you're if the machine that's the source of your layback audio is chasing timecode from the HDCam SR deck, then the machine itself has to decide whether it's going to present timecode on its back on its back plane of the machine, whether it's going to present the timecode in sync with the output video, or in sync with the tape, which is four frames ahead of that. So, of course, there's a fudge factor in the menuing, which allows you to choose whether the timecode that is coming out of the machine is in sync with the output of the machine, or whether it's four frames early. And the first few times that you do this, you don't even know that that menu option exists. So there's a tip for the unwary on it. So you're wondering why everything's not syncing up and all the numbers are right and what have you. That particular format of machine, and we can perhaps talk about this a bit later, points up the fact that we've really outgrown using tape as a storage medium, because clearly there's a reason why there's a requirement to have 160 milliseconds of processing time in order to get this video signal in a state and multiplexed up and whatever it is into a state that it can actually be printed onto the tape and demultiplexed on the way out. But if we've reached that stage that we're actually developing quite cumbersome machines, then I think we need to press ahead a bit further and to re-examine why it is that we want to continue using tape as a storage medium, and whether its inherent difficulties have sort of outgrown its usefulness. But there's another big topic. The other piece of equipment that I have issues with, just in terms of the sort of cost benefit of using it, is Dolby E process. And the costs of using it for me are again to do with latency, that it does occupy a considerable amount of time to multiplex the audio together, which is presented to the user as a single frame of delay. So if you're in a live event and you're required to send your output audio down the line in a transmission, then the transmission audio that hits your backplane of the truck or whatever it is already going to be 40 milliseconds behind the live action. And again, when the consumer decodes the audio, there's another 40 milliseconds of delay introduced there, which is fine because you could delay the video, or you could do whatever else it is you're going to do, or you could ignore it, I suppose. But if you're going to put a tape recorder in the equation as well, so that you can simultaneously do a live transmission and you can do a live recording, then you're left with having to have two paths of audio. And are you going to watch the delayed video? Are you going to watch the live video, the live audio, the delayed audio for your confidence that you have actually encoded it and decoded it adequately? And what am I saying? I'm saying that having such large latencies presents compromise, I suppose, because you invariably start watching audio which is out of sync, because you're mixing and matching, because at the minute you want to be listening to your confidence audio and you haven't been given a delayed video feed, for example. And so over time, I think it sort of dilutes your perception of what is normal on audio, whether you sort of get used to things being a little bit wrong on the lip sync. And
have I said enough for the minute?
You've said enough.
Can I throw it back to you for a minute?
You can throw it back to me.
Do many people use HD? HD cams here? Does anyone use any? Oh, you did? to define the problems that David was talking about?
Well, from a slightly different perspective, because actually I work for Sony.
Oh, okay.
That's an easy word here, I think. I work for systems integration, so obviously I know what I understand your concerns, and also I was working for the broadcast engineering before, so obviously I'm aware of what's happening. I mean, yeah, this might be a problem if it's not treated properly when the system is designed in the first place. The biggest remedy I can think of in terms of these latencies is definitely using the HDHDI embedded, because once you treat the audio and video together and you align it properly, especially in the live transmission, obviously at least you try to mitigate the problem and have the audio and video in sync, and then you can ensure that it leaves the track in sync. Although it doesn't necessarily solve the problem of what actually you are trying to listen. Incoming feed or Dolby E pre-compressed or after the compression, and then have latencies. So, yeah, I understand this is a problem, yeah.
Mm. And it is a problem that has emerged since having high-definition digital. It was a working practice that you never had to deal with in standard definition analog days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The good news is with let's say expanding technologies, let's say towards HD and now 3G, and also because of the SLW machines, as I said, we've got 12 channels. I have noticed that there is a tendency, growing tendency, of getting out from Dolby technologies and going directly into the discrete channels, which is good news, because this complication just disappears. There are ways of controlling that during the transmission, but again, live transmission is one thing, it might go okay, but then if you deal with post-production and then you have different feeds, like coming from the wireless camera, which is exactly not in sync, and then some it is not taken care of during the post-production, of course, this is potentially a big problem as well. So it's a combination of issues, I believe, during production itself and later on the post-production. So, yeah, it's an open point, and every now and then we have these discussions again, because there's another point which has been just recently identified. So, yeah.
That's interesting.
Okay. Have you anything to add to this?
No, pretty much okay. What David said, we had to find out all these things.
In terms of sync, and I think our bugbears at this point, that kind of covers most of my thoughts on this. Is there anything?
Yeah, perhaps I could just give some user feedback to Sony, which is what I imagine. Non-technical user, what I imagine might be a good next step would be to maintain the HDCam SR deck with all its functions in there, but instead of having a slot where you can put a tape in, can you have a slot where you can put some more digital storage, like a hard drive or something like that, because my impression is that when the data's on a hard drive, it's not locked in time so much, and that if you want to have certain channels from the machine coming out earlier than others, because there is some internal latency on the machine, then you can command the storage to start playing sooner, and it seems to me that that's a function that you can do with hard disk storage that you can't really achieve with tape storage.
I think you're correct. To be honest, I haven't investigated that internal latency in so many details, but on the other hand, I wouldn't be very much surprised if it's like that, taking into account the complexity of the whole system and maintaining the tape itself. When we think about the bit rates inside, it's enormous. Mm-hmm. It has to be right all the time, so I can't even imagine this mechanism inside. moving forward from that, I would imagine also we are entering anyway a period of time when we will probably slowly move towards the hard drive storage or the solid media storage anyway, because it is a necessity, and that might be relief. Although I'm not sure what at the moment is happening.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But I would imagine in the next couple of years that would be the next logical step.
That seems to make sense with what David's saying as well, in that we can then have additional metadata that kind of lets us know what's going on, and we can advance or delay whichever aspect we wish to bring it all back into sync. All we need to do is do that shot by shot, perhaps, and find the missing frame. Okay. Oh, sorry, Sean.
Is there an additional difference in latency between screen and projector? So projectors seem to have a latency.
Yes, and I think that's another minefield. And sometimes the manufacturers will specify what the latency of the display is, and sometimes they won't. And sometimes I think the latency is different at different times. For example, if it's changing frame rates, or I don't know, whatever. So why the manufacturers can't make it a nice round number, like saying exactly two video frames or exactly one video frame, but it seems to be, I don't know, whatever it is, 63 milliseconds or something.
Why doesn't the domestic unit do it internally?
Well, I think...
That's what I always ask myself.
Yeah, I suppose I'd have assumed that the that if you send audio and video to the display, then the loudspeakers on the display are delayed by the same amount. I'd have assumed that, but we don't generally monitor like that, do we? We monitor on our studio speakers, and we have the video on the screen.
True.
Because that comes the next thing when we try and do a layback, let's say, to HDSR. If we want it on a nice big screen so that we can actually see the drummer, that he's hitting it in sync, it's turning up a frame and a half later on the pictures anyway, and we've got to put another delay on the end of the audio out of the machine just to be sure that we really are listening and watching what we think we are. And then we've got to be confident when we've put a long chain of devices together. Not intending to get HDSR there, but it is something that does give us quite a challenge. If we now move on to something else, a different aspect, if we now that so much recorded audio that's sent to us for mastering is digital, it's been digital from pretty much 3 feet after the microphone, and it stayed that way. This has led to a number of things turning up that we don't expect. Quite often, you know, it's been over-processed, let's say, repeatedly in a digital audio workstation. It may have multiple layers of dither on it. It starts to question whether we need any more dither or noise shaping, or whether we'd ever hear any difference. It's sometimes been totally over-compressed as well. And then people bring it to us and start to ask, can we master it? Things. Now, do you have anything, any specific thoughts on this? List of do's and don'ts on this in this area? Ray.
Okay, I think first instance is the most serious issues we're seeing with files arriving is files being maximised, limited, compressed, as Christopher has already mentioned, such that they're actually unusable. It's not unusual for us to actually have to go back to a client and say, can we have something else, or can you take that limiter off of it, because there's nowhere for us to go. First thing you often have to do with the file that arrives is turn it down, which is ridiculous. I think a lot of this still stems back to a lot of the issues with having with digital and digital levels full stop. And I still sort of go about my pet problem where I think Yeah, for good reason. All the digital manufacturers made everything with a peak meter, with a peak over indicator, and they're worried about the peak content of the audio, which has got nothing to do with level, nothing to do with apparent loudness, nothing to do with average levels across the tracks. It had no reference to anything that was like a VU. Okay, within major studios, people still have VUs, and we can reference to something to give us an average level. But what's happening is a lot of this is now being worked all in digital, totally within box, often at home in small studios where they don't have outboard access to VUs or anything else, and they don't even have any knowledge of how to cross-reference between a VU and a PPM at all. I still think it's about time that the major DAW manufacturers actually started to make a usable display within the systems that would give you a reference point for volume. So, in other words, an average reference level, which would, to my mind would be probably around minus 14 dBFS. And ask people to work to that level. Stop giving them the target of this peak level that they have to attain. Try to educate them that actually there's a different place to be. You should be working at a lower level. And in the same way as we had room for an overshoot in the old days, the old analog days, you would have some sort of room for overshoot on an average level. Certainly there is a meter out there which has been quite widely downloaded, which is the TT dynamic range or something, I can't remember what it is, which is quite a clever little display. It actually shows you the at the top of the box, it actually shows you the density of your mix. It's quite not unusual for me to get mixes in and probably find the dynamic range using one of these meters is around 3 or 4 dB. It's just solid red. The other issues with files coming in, I don't know how far you want me to go down this other list because it's this list here. Do you want me to get into this area yet?
If you like.
You want me to get into there?
Yeah, if you
like. The other issues which we're seeing is file delivery and how it's arriving at the studio. Initially, most files used to arrive either on a CD-ROM, a DVD-ROM, or a hard drive, now memory sticks, and of course, more recently, files are coming across the net. There's a lot of debate going on about whether these files should be zipped, data compressed, whether interleaved, non-interleaved, and these are all giving us a number of issues. I think certainly some people are using zipping methods which are altering the quality of the audio before it arrives to us. I have done some tests where we've zipped files and we can hear the difference even if it's supposed to be lossless. I don't know why, I can't explain that. And of course we get into the issues of interleave files and non-interleave files, because it would seem that some DAWs are outputting or rendering out a stereo file that actually is not comparable to the two left and right files it's recorded. So all these issues are giving us a lot of problems at the high-end mastering end, where we're trying to really make sure the data is correct and it's the best possible source that we can get. Half our job now is actually working with the client, trying to draw out how he's worked, how he's mixed the product, what's the best we can get actually out of his workstation before we even start to do the mastering session.
Thank you. I mean, some files come in as MP3s as well, because people compile their mixes in their iTunes and then they already have their iTunes set to import with MP3. So that's something to watch out for as well.
Yeah, we have actually, we've had a year or two back, we had a client turn up with something that they recorded a major act only a fortnight previously. They'd spent 3 days in the studio. They'd then spent a couple of days afterwards sending files back and forth to their record company to approve which mixes they'd go with, vocal up, vocal down, whichever. And they turned up at the mastering session with a stack of files, which were all WAVs. And they'd all come from MP3s. And when they started to look, the more they searched, the less they found. And they found that in the space of only a fortnight, they had actually succeeded in
losing, erasing, whatever, all versions that were anything other than reconstructions from the MP3s. It's deeply, deeply concerning. I mean, going to what Ray has said, you know, at the end of the day, somebody, hopefully somebody in the studio at some point actually does listen. You know, back in the analog days, we used to mix to tape and quite often listen off tape. If we were doing dynamic cuts on the desk, we'd actually go back and actually play the master back afterwards and just check it was all there and that it sounded the way we used to think it sounded at the moment we mixed it. It's alarming how many times we can get mixes turned up that have been printed off late at night by an assistant because they've laid everything down on the workstation and then they've told the assistant to do, you know, all the stems, all the vocal up, the cappella mixes, the backing track mix and the TV track. And when we go to some of these, we find they've all got lead vocal on them. Because somebody left it unmuted and didn't actually listen to it. And that's got all the way to a mastering house before anyone, and we're the first person who's ever actually played that file back. And at that point, you have to start questioning all the files you've got.
Yeah, I'd actually like to give an example. I was working on an album last Thursday, Friday. The album was a very interesting project. And I tried to extract out these guys whether or not they actually had any that hadn't been run through rather famous Peak Limiter. And whilst we were working, these were the only files they had. They weren't overly compressed or limited, but they would definitely have been through a limiter. And as we were working, we could notice there was a lack of stereo in the tracks. It was very strange. It wasn't as though it was mono. It just didn't have space and time. It didn't have any dimension to it. And also, there was people, as we were working, there were three or four of us in the room, and of course they're supposed to be familiar with the work. They're supposed to be familiar with what they've listened to in the mixes, and they're saying, well, I don't remember this. You sure this mix was this? And, yeah, I don't remember that being quite that dense or whatever. And what it was is they were confused because they had mixed the album and they hadn't. They'd listened to it at the time of mixing, uncompressed and unlimited. Then they'd rendered it with a Peak Limiter, listened to that at home. So they'd actually lost all the point of reference. They didn't really know what their mix was because they had two different versions of each one flying around. They didn't really, in essence, know what they had. And so we had to then work back, certainly on about half the tracks, and certainly to obtain the stereo on a couple of the vocal tracks, we had to go back to stage and make sure they were unlimited. So it's really, I mean, in terms of, you know, working practices, it's something I really recommend is do not render out high level or any Peak Limited tracks and use that as your reference. Your mix is your mix. What is actually there is not what some late at night someone's bunged on and said, oh, let's just make it a bit louder so the record company is happy.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a vicious cycle because you get a few different mixing engineers sometimes mixing an album. So one engineer will mix it really hot for the record company, the artist loves it. Then the other mix engineer has to match this mix engineer's mix and make it that loud. So that by the time it ends up in the mastering, you really don't have a choice and you can't get everybody to run out mixes again.
One of the things that used to be happening, just certainly, it probably still is happening, was that some engineers would do two versions of the mix. One that was just to send to A&R for kind of approval, which they'd thump through a well-known digital compressor just to make it loud so that the A&R guy wasn't going, how come it's so quiet? And then they'd deliver two mixes to the record label. So one that was relatively uncompressed and one that was hammered just for audition purposes. Quite often the uncompressed one would be at 96K, 24-bit. The other one, of course, would be just 44:16, so it's sort of comparable CD type level and expectation. And when these were being produced out on DVD-Rs or whatever, or CD-Rs, it was very easy to see what the labelling was. and it would quite often say, you know, the number of times I was presented with a disc, which would actually say, you know, 44K, listening copy only. And you kind of go, well, this is only a listening copy. Where's the master? Oh, I prefer the sound of this one. It's like, yes, I know this one thumps, but can you send me the other one? Or give me the other disc. And sometimes we get it, sometimes we wouldn't. I mean, Ray will probably have, I mean, we have the advantage at Metropolis that we've got a studios next door. If it was mixed in the studios, we could usually go downstairs and find the other copy. And on occasions, dare I say, despite what A&R wanted, we did go and do that. The danger is now, of course, they don't turn up on CDR, DVDR, or even in a folder on a hard drive. They're just turned up. We're sent a random selection of files and told this one will be track three. Or in one case, we were sent an email saying, for label copy, please download from Amazon. It happens. But we are, you know, we when they actually send the files to us digitally, we now have no provenance. There's, even if the, even if somebody knows somewhere how to put in some relevant metadata, it's not inserted. And that is something that we desperately need, and need to be activated more often, some information to be put into the files.
There's another little, just talking about the peak level thing that you were just referring to, there's another little story of a friend of mine who was mastering a engineer ran into a couple of years ago when I didn't realise it was possible. But a lot of the media players now do have this averaging device that if you have a very large file, it turns the level down, gives you an average RMS level. So if you're mixing up different versions of the same song, it equalises it out. So it really starts to, in fact, disadvantage those tracks that are mastered too loud because they then sound quiet. But this friend of mine had mastered a record, sent it to the guy in A&R, and he said, well, it's okay. He said, but can I have it a bit louder? I said, okay. Didn't want to do it. He pushes it a couple of dB louder, sends it off, and the guy says, it's quieter. He said, you know, yeah, I wanted it louder. He said, but I did make it quieter. Okay, I'll give it another couple, sends it out, and the guy goes, no, it's quieter still. And all it was is the software, as loud it was getting, it was pushing it down all the more. So the vicious circle was just...
I think iTunes, because I've had that quite a few times, iTunes defaults on that setting, which is, what's it called? Anybody know? Sorry? Yeah. I'm not sure, the exciter sort of mode, and when that happens, it pushes the lead vocals down a bit as well. So if you want to check your mix, it's probably better to listen to a CD player or have that turned off. Yeah, you can take it off, yeah.
Well, I mean, one feature, one thing we've had is that, you know, on occasions, you know, we've sent out files or discs to people to listen to for audition, you know, reference discs, and they start ringing up and say, yeah, it's fine, but we get to the third track and it's distorting. And after a lot of chat, you discover, yeah, they've got it slammed in the computer, they've got a wire out back onto their stereo, but they're playing it out through iTunes, off their laptop or whatever, and then you sort of say, well, go through every step, and you say, well, have you got the graphic equalizer in? Oh yeah, it makes it sound much better on the laptop. And you're like, well, can you play it flat? Yeah. And, you know, of course, nobody subtracts anything, do they? They only ever add. There's no point in putting minus values on a graphic at that level.
Right, you're talking about loudness there. Mm. There are some moves afoot in TV to have some standardisation going on. Mm. I mean, they're kind of fledgling at the minute, and there's a range of different standards and options. But it's gaining some sort of momentum. And is anything like that happening in your
sphere? No. I mean, I've been aware of the moves with, I think really it's TC and Dolby are in competition primarily to set some sort of standard in broadcasting. I think it does really reflect back to what we're doing in audio mastering. and really what we're doing in audio broadcasting, radio, because, you know, whatever, 30, 40, 50 years ago, everyone used to, for AM broadcast, FM broadcast, they would compress it every very, very heavily to try and get some sort of, you know, coverage, of territorial coverage for the broadcasts. Now we've moved into this digital era, and we have a problem where the recording engineers are slamming it before it gets to the mastering. The mastering engineers, some of them, are slamming it. It then goes to radio, which slams it, and then it gets to someone's, you know, PC at home or whatever, which, you know, again, normalises it and slams it. So at the end of the day, it's, you have nothing. There's no consistency. No, there is really a serious option to, you know, that should be discussed about saying, well, you know, to my mind, when you finish mastering your product, it's at that point really that the record company, the mastering engineer, hopefully the artist, all those people who are very involved and care about that project should say, I'm signing this off. This is how I want the listeners to hear it. This is what I think my music should sound like. And that is what should be delivered for public consumption. There should be some sort of method where we can have some sort of standardised levels so that when it leaves us, when it's broadcast, it, you know, those textures, the levels, the quality of what you've produced should be retained, and so that people can understand what the artist wanted to deliver. You know, some artists, I can think of several things which we've done which have been very mellow, very smooth, and that's what the artist really wants. And it comes on the radio and it's just shrill because they have, you know, they're using some multi-band compressor. But there is there's no longer this necessity with digital broadcasting as well for to try to look for territorial distribution, because it's not happening anymore. It's, you know, it's not an issue. And there was this lovely test done in America. I think it was called the Tardum test, after an American mastering engineer, where he invited a number of people to. He sent out a song. He said, just to different mastering engineers, come guys, just master this. Do it as you want. And there's a lovely picture where he took the songs in Sonic Solutions, and you can see the density of each mastering engineer's mix, and they were all over the place. Several dB of dynamic range difference between each one. He then sent them off to Auburn, and Auburn put them through their standard Optimod setting, and they all came back exactly the same. So you have to question where is the benefit in what we're doing. You know, we should be getting it back to how we make it at the mastering room, that the artist is happy with what he's doing. Then that should be presented to the world as being the finished product.
Some of the work, following on from that, Darcy Proper in Belgium and now the Netherlands, she's moved, did some work last year and the year before with Auburn, and had a look at a number of different levels, let's say, of mastering, and what the effect was going through an Optimod. And although he wouldn't leave the Optimod with her, he did have various local or various independent radio stations kind of settings that he could recall on it. And okay, this was European, so it wasn't sort of Capital Radio and Absolute and what have you here, but all those settings, he freely admitted, were, you know, quite outside their guidelines, in that they were all slammed to get it substantially louder than Auburn had ever intended the device to be used. But one of the things they found, in fact, was if you sort of took a sort of 20-year-old CD that probably peaked something like about +4, +3, +4 VU, and then you went and found a contemporary reissue of that CD, which probably now peaks +8 or +9, if not more. But when put through, let's say, a standard popular radio station's settings on the Optimod, it actually came out sounding quieter. And as the track built and headed towards the chorus, the vocal would just sink, to the point where on some of the mixes and some of the settings of the Optimod, you'd actually get to the you know, the money shot where you get to your chorus where you've got the killer line and you couldn't hear it. It was just buried in mush. And the whole mix hadn't just got quieter. The whole thing had gotten, well, it sounded grey, if that's a useful analogy. It had no life left in it.
I mean, you listen to the radio now and everything is just this just that one sonic aggression. And there's nothing to draw you into.
But on the other side of this, probably about 6-9 months ago, I got this TC meter.
All right. Okay.
And spoke to the people at Channel 4 and said, you know, what are the guidelines? What are you working towards? And the engineer there explained that they have guidelines for commercials and for their linking pieces, which are this number, and he gave me the numbers. But he said, we haven't got any guidelines for long-form programmes that we transmit. Why not? Well, because it would be technically... it would be commercially too difficult to insist that the programs that we transmit adhere to these guidelines that we present, because we're sourcing programs from here, there and everywhere that are made in different territories under different circumstances, whatever it is. So it would just be hard work to kind of make our programmes adhere to any sort of single guideline. But nevertheless, since I got the meter, and I'm kind of on board with the idea of not trying to slam things, I thought, well, I know what the commercials have to adhere to, so I'll try mixing some of my programmes with those guidelines. And it kind of works okay, but there are... There's some sorts of programs that it's actually really difficult to mix like that, and I'm thinking of one where I've just sort of thrown in the towel and said, well, look, I'm just going to slam it, which is actually stand-up comedy, because it just doesn't sound nice if you have wide dynamic on the and have the TC meter giving those numbers. It's just not dense enough.
No, I mean, it's the same with music. I mean, you can't say that music can't be slammed or hammered because some music sounds good that in that fashion. It has to be treated that way. Even distortion sometimes has to be added to make it work. And so it's not a... I'm not advocating that we shouldn't be doing any of those techniques. It's just this generalised, well, we should have a good platform where, you know, even different genres, if you play one after another, should be able to be a reasonably equal sort of volume, and it shouldn't need post-modifications, or EQing or a treatment of broadcast and stuff like that.
But I don't quite know how I would do it if I was given a specification that I had to adhere to, and say mix this stand-up comedy within these guidelines, it would just end up really, really quiet.
I had a nice television once when I was working at Sony. I did a staff purchase and bought a TV, and as you were saying, the commercials are always slightly louder than often the programmes to grab attention.
The commercials now are at the given level, and it's the programmes that are quieter.
Well, this television used to give me a warning every time the commercials came on, because the intensity of the sound, the screen went green. That television went back several times before Tony managed to get that right.
We've got a question from over there.
You are all master engineers, so I just wanted to ask you if when you're playing back to clients, do you ever give them an AV and say, and when you give them an AV, give them an equal RMS's so they can hear the difference between something that's, you know, at the same level. So they're competing at the same playing field, basically.
Yes.
And because I find that a lot of times we can do that and say, look, this is your overcompressed version and this is your dynamic version. Which one do you prefer? When they hear them in equal RMS, they'll say, well, I actually prefer the one with more dynamics.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think the only thing to watch out for there is that you're looking at two problems. You're looking at the comparison between the processed version and the unprocessed version, and at the same volume, they may obviously the
uncompression. But
if you're working and you know this is it's a real world, there are clients want it loud, then you're actually trying to demonstrate there will be an element of damage done to the audio if you're going to go that loud. Mm. And you're trying to what's the word? You've got that. There's a point where they've got to accept that if they're going to have it that loud, that's the damage that they're going to, you know, they're going to have done to the audio, and that's the sound they're going to get.
Yeah, it's not unknown for us to, you know, we get a client come in that we've got the artist, we've got the producer, we've got the album engineer there on a mastering session. They'll go, look, we don't want to hammer this. Go easy. Keep the dynamics.
Look at this is good.
And you know, we do exactly what they want. We get to 8 in the evening or whatever. Put the whole album together. Got a nice sound on it. We print them all a CD each. They all go home. We print another CD. We send that over to A&R in a nameless record company. The next morning, hour and a half later, the phone rings. Just what the are you guys playing at? I paid you to, you know, I'm paying you guys to master this. Why is it so quiet? And you kind of go, well, that's what the artist wanted. That's what the producer wanted. That's what the engineer wanted. They wanted to retain the dynamics. To hell with them, says the A&R guy. What do they know about trying to sell music? I want it loud. You know, if you don't make it loud, I won't pay you bill. I'll just take it somewhere else and I'll make it loud. Nobody in A&R wants to be the guy who sends, you know, nobody wants to take the risk, I think, of putting out, let's say, a quiet record. I mean, it may just have no songs on it, and that might be the reason why it doesn't sell, but they don't want the risk that if it doesn't sell, that somebody says, you're fired, because you're the guy who put out a quiet record. And I think there's an element of that.
But you don't have to use a compressor necessarily. I mean, if the mix doesn't need a compressor, you don't have to use a compressor to make it loud. There's other ways to make it loud and still retain dynamic. So
we're suddenly getting a lot of questions. Who wanted to ask a question?
It's really that there's a geriatric mastering engineer. I've been there for a long, long time. It's the emperor's new clothes. Loudness is the emperor's new clothes. Everybody's running scared, as you say. You know, you put it out and it didn't sell, maybe because the song is lousy. But nobody wants to stand up and say, this is the way it should be. Because also remember a certain post-mortem on a bit of a disaster in the business, when somebody stood up and said, remember that record company staff are usually of a very low intelligence. And I'm afraid it hasn't changed. Everybody's running scared. Until somebody's prepared to say, look, I worked my backside off on that album, we've spent a fortune on the mixing and the mastering, and it's not going to be screwed up just because somebody can say, yeah, but it's loud. You know, somebody's got to stand up and take the risk of that. Maybe that will be the crack in the dike.
I don't think it will. I think the crack in the dike will be only come when we have, you know, people realise that actually what's going out there is being damaged and starts actually sounding quieter because it's too loud. And I think that's going to be the thing that's going to mess it up.
I mean, a spin-off might happen from these new projected metering methods for TV, and that might be that at some point this might filter back, let's say, into radio. And wouldn't it perhaps be a great thing if suddenly all these radio releases that are sent to radio, suddenly the BBC and independent radio suddenly says, no, they're the wrong spec, you can't broadcast it, do it again. On the other hand, how we'll cope when, you know, we've suddenly got to produce a new, let's say, a new mastered version that's, let's say, only plus 6 VU when the master came in at plus 14. And we've had them louder than that. I mean, I think about plus 17 is the loudest VU. Plus 17 VU is about the loudest peaks I've seen so far.
Trying to ask a question.
Yes, sorry.
Oh, hi. The thing is, you've covered so many things I really want to ask a question about. The loudness problem, you're saying as mastering engineers, you provide them with a decent master, one that's slammed. I say decent, you understand, I'm very bigoted about this and really get very worked up about it. But I don't understand why it's not possible, for example, to release two copies. We can have a slammed copy for people who, and then a high definition copy that people could download. People like me who've got decent stereo and want to be able to hear the dynamic.
I think it's just sheer economics. Yeah, the record companies just won't do it. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And
I think now they're going to start
mastering everything twice, essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, there are two ways of working in practice in a mastering room, okay? One is you may, for instance, equalise or change or manipulate whatever you want to do to the sound, record that into a digital medium, you know, maybe a workstation, and then when you deliver the CD master, you may put on whatever heavy digital processing you're going to do. That's one way of working. Yes, you could extract two different versions quite easily like that. A lot of mastering engines actually don't do that. They actually go through the whole chain, EQ, digital compression, etc., and all they have is the digital, heavily digitally compressed versions. And I understand where you're coming from. I just think in the real world, there's very few people would actually do that for you. And it's even like, look, when you talk about, say, providing MP3s or WAV files, there's a few companies starting to do that because they see the benefit of providing the high-quality WAV rather than an MP3. But I've never seen anyone want to do the difference in levels.
Well, certainly there's one remaster that's come out recently, called The Nice Band on the Run. Yeah, Women's Round Band on the Run. That's available as a high-def download, either the original master or the remaster without dynamic compression. And then there's the commercial CD available, which presumably has been made louder, since most remastering seems to involve removing the middle and making it louder, which is another thing that saddens me. I mean, I've done measurements that show that my old LPs actually have more dynamic range than some of the remastered CDs. Absolutely. Oh, and incidentally, they also sound better, which is not to do with them being LPs, it's just
Yeah, I mean, but that's even going back to, I do a lot of vinyl cutting for audiophile type disc cutting, and it's really nice when you put on old analog tapes, and they've got body, they've got scale, you set them to a nominal level and you go, great. But you put on a digital recording, it will often sound small.
Yeah.
It just does not have that density and that warmth and body.
If I could say just one other thing, I think education could have quite a lot to do here. I teach at Anglia Ruskin on the audio music technology course. I get students coming through sometimes who've been taught by well-meaning but misinformed music tech teachers who are quite a lot of the time they're converted music teachers, but they'll come along and say, oh, when I've recorded this, I've got to normalise it. And this is one of them. Whenever I change something, change the sample rate, what's the other one? Oh, it's adding compressors all over the place. The likes of Logic and Cubase and so on, you can load a compressor on absolutely everything. You know, sometimes I wish that all the were hardware compressors, because then at least there's a limited number of them available.
Exactly. I've had the same conversations. I was recently at Worthing University. I gave a presentation down there, and I was trying to explain to them, when you're doing a mix, don't just put a compressor in there because you've got it.
Yeah.
You put it in there for a reason. You don't normalise it because you can. You normalise it for a reason. Everything you do for a reason.
Yeah.
And quite often, you know, they'll load up a template and it's got all the compressors in or the EQs in. The EQs may even be flat. But you listen to an a VST or a DirectX plugin, and it's affecting the audio when it's just in.
Yeah.
And they're not going back to what is straight and what is the basic sound they've got, and they don't know how to build it up. Mm. And then when they come to do the mix, what they're doing is going through all these compressors and using the compressors to make the mix for them.
Yeah.
Rather than actually being creative and making the mix.
Yeah. I think there's one other thing which is very damaging, which is the fact that young people on the whole don't get to listen to really good quality sound.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked to a couple of 30s recently who only ever listen to MP3s, and I say to them, look, you're in the final year of a music tech course. It's really about time you started wrapping your ears around quality sound. It worries me in the sense that I think the eye's been taken off the ball. Quality of sound. You know, I record my LPs at very high sample rates and very high quality and play them to students who more or less sit there and go, what's happened? Why are your 30-year-old LPs sounding so much better than my MP3s and my 1 or 2-year-old CDs?
See, the next stage is actually don't record it into digital, play the record to them.
Yeah,
that's
well.
But that's also because the person who's recording it, I mean, the artist is recording it, it's one person doing everything. Well, as back then, 30 years ago, you had like a proper engineer, you had a specialist arranger, a specialist. There were so many specialists. Well, now there aren't any.
Okay. Just rewinding on something you said earlier about the possibility of, let's say, a dual inventory where you've got, you know, the super crushed one and the not so crushed one. Something that a year or so back sort of emanated from America from a discussion, and I don't know whether it's led anywhere, was from Rick Rubin, who is probably a pioneer of squashing everything to oblivion. And in his position then as head of Columbia, he started to warm to the idea of perhaps dusting off some of those Red Hot Chili Peppers records and possibly even recalling the mixes and slamming them less and then remastering them with a lot less compression. But his motivation wasn't really because there was an audiophile audience out there, you know, that would appreciate this. I'm afraid it was purely led from commercial roots that it would sell, you know, another, you know, million copies. You know, and there's the completists, so of course we'll go and buy one of everything anyway.
See, I think with digital remastering, a lot of the time, a lot of people haven't heard just how good the original masters were. They may have heard them on record players, but record players, unless they were phenomenally expensive, really weren't that good at reproducing what was on the record. And early CDs suffered from the problems inherent with early converters and didn't sound that nice.
Mm.
So I think a lot of the time...
And many were not done from the original master.
Can I just say that also, when some mastering, and you can do it, as Maz has intimated, that you can actually get the level pretty high without damaging it, is actually having the wherewithal, knowing where to stop. You know, you can actually apply things and get them reasonably loud, and it's just that knowing and demonstrating to people actually, you know, you go this, you know, just that half dB bit more, that dB more, it actually starts. There is that sort of break point where you can actually still do a reasonably loud job without actually damaging it.
I think Nevermind by Nirvana is a good example of that. That's loud, but it's actually beautiful to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a question.
I'd like to ask your opinion on noise, as in the noise floor. I record classical music, and it's tempting, perhaps not a tracking stage, but certainly mixing stage, to put in high-pass filters and EQ and get rid of some of the subsonic rubbish. But then something tells me probably you should leave it in and leave you guys to either get rid of it or not, in a more subtle way. And from we've just been talking about old analogue records sounding good. Is that partly because they've got a bit of nice warm noise in them, and they're not, we don't eradicate all the low frequencies, we stamp on them and make something that's really...
I think you'll look at, sort of, again, it's a working practice, isn't it? I personally would not, and all the orchestral work, for instance, that's done at AIR, they don't by default roll off all the bass and the rumble and everything else. Because, you know, in of itself, every high-pass filter is going to have an effect. I mean, it may take rid of the rumble, but it's going to, you know, it's going to have bandpass ripple going back up into the audio. So it's going to have an aural effect on the sound. In terms of noise, it depends what, you know, if it's room noise or ambient noise, then that's
what I call humanities.
Yes, it is. It's real.
It's real.
But it's when it's distracting. Yeah, and I think if it's distracting, then
continuous sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there is a certain thing where you get used to a certain level of hiss through a particular recording, and after a while you switch off.
Yes.
And and of course, the other thing is, I don't know if you've come across this, but I noticed on some notes that Christian's made here later on, he actually starts talking about dithering. And of course, there is an issue with dithering and how you apply it, where you apply it, the kind of dither you apply, and that will be affected by the amount of noise that is inherent in the recording, because especially when you come from some analog sources, then you could actually say that some of that noise that you've recorded is actually having an effect similar to dither and will actually influence the dither that you're having. So, there's no easy answer to all those. It's I won't do it by default. That's what I'm saying.
No, so if
you
think that, you just leave it all in.
Yeah, as we said, as long as it's not distracting, as long as it's not damaging the performance.
Yeah.
DC is a different one.
Yes.
I had one the other day, not DC flying through the fire.
That's right. There is another aspect to this on why sometimes old releases, particularly, you know, 40-year-old tape, why that vinyl copy, if you've got a pristine A1 pressing, why it might sound better than the last year's reissue. That's because when that was made, the tape was new, and when it was made redone last year, the tape had been played 4,000 times in between. And actually, some of these masters are knackered.
Yeah.
Sorry, I probably shouldn't say that, but you can see through some of them.
You can actually get sometimes the original master, and the quality isn't great. But you might find a safety copy that just hasn't been played because it was a safety and it's been in some archive somewhere, and it will sound much better than the actual master.
Yeah.
I've recently been through, you know, I won't say some of these things. But certain projects where I've had anything up to half a dozen different copies of the same album, the safety copies and the masters mixed back in the 70s, and unfortunately they all do sound different. So, things were great in the 70s, but, you know, there were a lot of things wrong as well. So sometimes the copies were not good either. Yeah. They're very bad copies.
We had a project last year, and it was almost like a holy grail. We had a master of a well-known act, and it was knackered, worn out, basically. And there were two copies, safety copies, that had been made at the time of the mix, one on the 8th of the month and one on the 9th of the month. And the 8th had written all over it, "Do not use, wrong running order." And the one on the 9th had been played by every Tom, Dick and Harry and was knackered because they played it on Revoxes and anything they could back in the day, because they thought, it doesn't matter, it's a safety copy. And you open up this one in the wrong running order and it's fantastic because it's not been touched since the day it was put in the box. And it's in a funny way, it's like finding the Holy Grail. You suddenly go, this is as good as it gets, and you kind of, you don't have to play it.
You just put it through a digital compressor,
smash it, release it. Straight to MP3. There you go. Anything to add? I think we should probably broaden. Now, something that did come up there that is in my notes is about dithering, and, you know, it was actually possibly a bit of a rhetorical question in my notes about, what's the point of dithering? As Ray said, you know, if you've got a nice old analog recording which has got a quantity of, you know, real noise. After all, dither's only artificial noise in a random package. Real noise is just noise in a random package. Do we need dither? In a different sense, though, with the stuff that has, like, spent its life in, you know, a workstation, it's been normalised repeatedly, it's then got compressors here, there and everywhere, how many times has it been bounced back to a new track. It's got dither applied, and then it's got, you know, 25 dBs of bus compression, let's say, at the end of it. And so that, even, let's say, 16-bit dither that was sitting there at about 94.5 dBs down is now somewhere up at about 50 or 60 dBs. And some of those elements, let's say, you know, odd individual instruments that have been slammed and what have you, you've got all these noise, this noise that's just starting from minus 50 downwards, that is just mush and noise that's in there. When we used to sort of 16, 18 years ago, when we sort of 20-bit was the thing and noise shaping was in its infancy, we suddenly had, we could dither, or we had two or three different types of noise shaping, and we could agonise almost for hours, track by track, going, which is the best noise shape to use? And it mattered, and it made a difference. And I am sad to say, on a lot of recordings nowadays, it makes sod all difference. If you switch it off, it's difficult to tell, you know, you just go, well, it's not the same, but it's not really, not, one's not better than another. It's just, and, you know.
I don't know, I find that they are different. I mean, I mean, choose them selectively.
Yeah, no,
it
doesn't seem quite such a, I don't know, the differences don't seem as big anymore, particularly on over-processed material.
Well, certainly on over-processed, but I think also some of the so-called super sort of noise shaping things are not as wonderful as the, you know, some of this basic triangular.
Yes.
It's just as good if it's applied properly. Mm. Or put a bit of tape noise over it is much better.
Yes. It works very nicely.
And it'll tape noise running parallel.
Yeah.
And it can do a much better job.
Yes. On that, let's move on to a different aspect of this. One of the things we, you know, with the absence, let's say, of a tape box, and with the propensity to produce so many files in the studio, you know, all called master, but then there'll be a master vocal up 1 dB, and then there'll be a master vocal up, backing vocals up 1 dB, and there's a master kick drum up, and there's a master with these down. So it's not unknown for us to literally open the box. We don't have a box, there's no label, they're just very simply labeled files, often no title, they're just in a folder called, you know, track title, and then it's just master one vocal up, master one vocal down, etc. It's not unusual for us to find anything up to 30 and more different mixes called master. And it's depending how they came to you, you can't just say, well, I'll go with the one with the newest timestamp, because depending how it was FTP'd to somebody and whether it was compressed or not compressed and what have you, it might just have yesterday's timestamp on it, but actually it's the oldest one. At some point we've got the case that, of course, they come in and they go, ah, actually we want the intro from this one, the middle eight from that one, you know, the end choruses we want from that mix, three different mixes, and we just put it together and we play. From there, we play it back and we do our mastering. But at which point does somebody somewhere, whose responsibility is it? Possibly another rhetorical question, but whose responsibility is it to keep track of which one of these is actually the master? When it was a, you know, when it was a tape box and something, you know, when there was some ambivalence, the mastering engineer sometimes used to get the red pen, put a line through it, and put a big M beside the one that really was the master and that it was mastered from. Plus, of course, if you did compile it from two or three mixes, there it was all spliced together. But nowadays, it's the mastering engineer who, for a period of about 25 minutes, might know which of those many mixes was the master. Everybody else in the room remembers for that 25 minutes. They're onto another track. They've forgotten. And we've got a legacy here sitting in mastering where we might be able to trace which one was the master when you want to remaster it in 20 years' time. Do we want to tell anybody? Do we have to? Is it our intellectual property?
I'm not sure we've got the energy to.
Well, it's for that.
That's virtually every project.
But, I mean, do you find any clients are keen to keep track of which elements are the master?
No, they just say, use that, use that, use that. And sometimes we have several mixes of the same thing, no one's keeping any record, and historically they'll come back to want to do something with it in 10, 20, 20 years' time, and they won't have a clue.
Ah.
So, neither would
that
I.
Might, cause that probably won't be I was going to say, that might be a benefit on some of the marsh we work on, if it's unremasterable in 20 years.
I've still seen something in analogue work. You know, I've worked on analogue stuff many years ago, and the artist comes back 20, 30 years later and goes, actually, no, I don't like that mix after all, but at least he knew what it was.
No.
And then he'll move on to a different mix or something.
At least that one might not be worn out.
Yeah, that's true.
And even...
No, I mean, you know, they don't even know which mix they chose, because they send you the MP3 they had and they say, can you find out which mix this was? So I think there's a documentation issue, of course, because people keep changing the file name as it goes from one person to another.
You know, I often wonder if we just... Because we can keep all the files if we've got big enough storage facility at the end of the day, we can. But I'm not sure whether we're doing something that's a legacy for the future that's a good thing, or whether we're just going to confuse the archaeologists in 2,000 years' time. You know, when they look at, why did they have 37 mixes called Master?
But by then your hard drive would have died.
Well, the hard drive seized,
It's all been a format the archaeologists won't understand, because everyone's forgotten how it's coded.
True. This is true.
Sorry, you were going to say something.
Yes, the last time that I went to Metropolis as a client, the value to me for doing that was actually to get a second opinion on everything, and to just sort of for a day or so hand off and say, well, Ray or Mazen or whatever, could you fix the issues that I've made and put everything right that I've overlooked, because I've been mixing it for too long. But when I took my work there to be mastered, and you'll be able to tell me whether anybody or a large proportion of people do this, I didn't bring any files with me. I didn't bring a file with a vocal or dB louder, this the dB quieter, whatever. But it just occurred to me that mastering engineers have to do a bit of re-engineering, reverse engineering, that if they want to make a particular instrument a little bit louder because the balance engineer got it wrong, then they've got quite clumsy tools to do that, in that they can only really operate on the whole mix. So what I took with me at that stage was I took my workstation with the mix playing live on it, so that if the if Mazen was to say to me, well, it's all very well, but the snare drum's too loud or whatever, we could actually turn the snare drum down in the mastering room and work it from there. So there, in a way, that's a better solution, in that it gives Mazen a sort of finer control over what he wants to achieve with mastering. But in a way, it kind of makes Crispin's problem worse, in that there isn't even one file, let alone 37 files, for the archaeologist to dig up, because it's just a piece of live mixdown of the multitrack. But do many of your clients bring stuff like that?
Mm. A few times, you get Pro Tools.
And is that something you'd encourage?
Well, I think it's two different issues. That if you're talking about... One of the problems you have is that if they've come from, shall we say, a studio environment where maybe the monitoring isn't great, and they pull it up on your monitoring and they go suddenly realise, oh, well, this is wrong. I've had issues where you may as well walk out for the day and just leave them to remix it again and just let them use your monitors to get the mixing right. And then there's huge cost implications and issues about that. Yes, it can be nice to be able to sit there and say, actually, you know, there's these tiny little things wrong and you can change it. And then you've got historical problems that nothing's ever backed up. But the other format, which is becoming quite popular, is stem mixing, where we receive the stems, usually six or eight or whatever tracks, essentially backing tracks, vocals, BVs, whatever combination is suitable for any song. And so it does give us a little bit more flexibility to overcome some of those issues, especially from people when they're working in an environment where the acoustics especially isn't very good, and it gives us a bit more of a scope to control vocals or sibilants or whatever.
Right. Yes.
I mean, this whole thing really comes down to what is the job of the mastering engineer? This is something that hasn't been discussed. What actually is his job and purpose?
Here's a list.
Well, it's like a post-production engineer almost now, rather than a transfer engineer, how it began, probably. And the last step to fix all these things, whether you get them in stems or the recording engineer is unsure and wants to bring in the Pro Tools rig and adjust the mix as you master it, which is a pretty good method as well. So you're doing anything to reach that the result, basically.
I think the problem is that I'm very much the kind of person, I think you should approach each particular aspect of the job with the right mindset. You go to mix something, you're in that sort of frame of mind to do that right kind of job. You come in frame of mind to mix it, EQ it, whatever it is. And I think the danger for mastering engineers is we're expected to do so much now. We are expected to sometimes be involved in the remixing, sometimes actually working with stems or the mixing. We're then expected to EQ it. We're then expected to get the levels right. We're expected to edit different versions together. We're putting out different versions of the same album. An album I've just done, there's going to be three different issues, versions of the issue. There's going to be one in the shops, one in Japan. There's the Tesco version, etc. So there's all these different things. Then you've got all the metadata to put in, whether it's ISRC coding, text, and all that sort of thing. And at the end of the day, actually, you find you've covered a scope of tasks which can be really fatiguing. Yeah. And very hard to actually, it goes back to a presentation I did many years ago for APRS, where it concerns me at the moment, especially within mastering, again, going back to QC control, because we are all so involved in so many different aspects at the mastering stage, and it's really hard to actually get the record company or the artist or management company, who's ever finally responsible, to actually QC what you've done properly before it is then sent to the factory. And they are so lazy, they just want the bug to stop there. And that's a serious issue which we still have today. Yeah.
Yes, it's a good point, actually.
Yeah, to some extent we're hooked to hang the blame on. From the client's perspective sometimes.
Yeah, we certainly are, but they're just, I mean, we've gone to the point, I think you've got it as well now, where, you know, we went, at least a few years ago, you could try and say to people, listen to the CD player. Yeah, you give them a CD to check first. Well, the problem was, is that I found, is that you could write a CD from one edit list one day on a workstation, and it isn't necessarily the same the next day. You know, it's software, things happen, things go wrong. And then today we do online mastering, because people are mastering for people around the world, and it's how do you get them to check what you've done before it goes to the factory. So up until recently, it was a couple of years ago, we got this OEM version of a DDP player, because files go out as a DDP now. It's a descriptive protocol format, which can be sent directly electronically from us to the factory for manufacturing, and then there was no one in between to check it. So now we do actually have software which we give to the client to say, okay, you can download that master too, and you can check it. You can check the metadata, you can check the audio, you can check everything for its master. And I think you do the same thing now, don't you?
Yeah, we do. I mean, another thing that just to touch on the side of that, from what Ray's saying, you know, we can send a reference disc out, and not only do we have that issue that, you know, the EDL nothing can change, but if we're noise shaping or whatever, we can end up with a slightly different data stream. But somebody might come back and they'll say to us, "Oh, can you change track 7? Can you, you know, we just want half dB more top end on it. Just give it a bit more air." And so you do. You revise track 7, and you send it out. You send them a new reference disc, and of course, they play track 7. they don't play the whole disc and approve the whole disc again. They're like, well, I didn't pay you to change anything else, so it must be the same. And you go, well, why should it be? Not least because I've had to move all the tracks down a bit, because actually, for whatever reason, depending on what the changes we've made, you know, it might be that the rest of the album's in a very slightly different position, so it isn't necessarily the same. But of course, they'll only listen to what they've perceived should have changed and not worry about the rest of it.
At the time of the particular problem, I pointed out that it's the fragmentation of production now between independent or pseudo-independent companies, departments and the rest. This kind of thing happens, and it's nobody's fault because it's nobody's job. In the old days, yeah, a traditional record company, you had a person whose job it was to check a test pressing which was from the same metal that would be used for the issue. And it was that one person's job. But nowadays, say, it can be just disappear into thin air, that nobody's job is to make sure that what hits the shops is what's supposed to hit the shops.
Even in vinyl nowadays, I mean, so many people, because you're talking about short run vinyls now, yeah, it's very rarely you're going to do more than, say, 2,000 or 5,000 pressings on any product. Yeah. Quite often, you know, a lot of these issues are maybe only 500 or something, 1,000 at most. And they just say, well, the cost implications of running a few test pressings is just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's like...
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a fight with the client for them to understand they've got to check it. Because as you know as well as I do, you cut a record and you only know what it really sounds like when you play it back.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, can I just tell you a little story I heard today, but it's true. It's somebody who's been in the business at least 50 years, A&R, and he had some discs cut, some 7-inch masters. He then phones the studio and says, yeah, the acetate sound great, now you can go ahead with mastering. The engineer said, that probably wrong, but
played the masters.
Actually doing any acetates. Also, but look, yeah, I have to put a couple of discs on the turntable because it was a big disc. So it played the masters.
Yeah, I've had that.
Yes. We're still dealing with people. Yeah.
No, I've had that, and it's just nuts, and you just don't know what to do. Just about dither, actually. It's a funny story about dithering. When I was at Sony, I used to work with Steve Shin, who some of you may remember, which he passed away a few years ago. But I remember Steve one day mastering an album, and he'd spent about 3 days mastering this album, being very full on with the band and the management. And he all had it all on his Sonic Solutions, all there, all the edits done, all the different EQ'd versions, all correct. And then he made the big mistake. He said, we just need to dither this and render it out to a CD. And someone said, what's dither? He said, oh, well, I've got this dither, I've got that dither, I've got this. I've got about half a dozen different dithers. And they said, oh, okay, well, let's hear that one first then. And he thought they were going to hear a snippet. Nope, whole album, right the way through. This was about 7-8 o'clock in the evening. He never went home until 6 in the morning. They listened to the album through every complete version, with, you know, super bit mapping, whatever it was. and he said at the end of the day he had no idea what was good or bad because he was totally fatigued.
Part of the danger is then you end up with a situation of, well, can we have this dither for the track one and track seven, but have that one for two?
Can't you do that?
Well, yeah, pay enough money, spend enough time. Something on a tangent, and this is probably to bite the hand that feeds again. Interesting story, rumour started out around the world of Apple and Mac, and it's sort of traced back to Jimmy Iovine, head of Interscope, legendary record producer. But there's a rumour out that Apple may be looking at selling higher quality downloads, 24-bit downloads. There's no definition of whether these will be 96k or 44k, 44.1. Also, it was also reported via CNN, so they started saying, well, you know, a 24-bit MP3, at which point it got a bit mangled because, of course, Apple doesn't actually sell MP3s anyway. But then they sort of mangled up, you know, about who's got the right hardware to play this back and things. But it does raise an interesting question of, you know, suddenly if, let's say, maybe it's just as... It looks actually like it's a concept that's been planted out there, just a pebble in the water to see where the ripples go and what it flushes out as ideas from people. And it certainly seems to... The ripples out in the marketplace seem to go, oh, this would be nice, you know, if we could have a higher quality copy. I mean, having said that, these people are currently buying an AAC download from the iTunes Music Store rather than buying a CD at 16-bit from Amazon. But it does raise a few interesting questions. So I don't know quite how Ray works internally. For a lot of the product we do at Metropolis, we do have, let's say, an interim master that's at 24-bit, maybe at 96K 24-bit, or certainly at 44K 24-bit, which obviously, for a fee, perhaps, it's not free. You know, we can open it up again and we can represent it to the record company. Having said that, we produced that master with the concept of it being turned into 16-bit at the end, and that's part of the sound we were possibly working towards. But there are these 24-bit masters, and it's... I was only bringing this point up because it's something that may arise in the next year or a couple of years, as the internet is forever faster and as people have got more storage at less cost. Of course, their iPod doesn't last any longer. And that if you actually put a 9624 track on an iPod and play it, the battery lasts about 50 minutes because the hard drive never stops spinning. It doesn't go to sleep. That aside, though, it'll be interesting to see, you know, if the record companies do actually come back to the mastering houses and ask, have you got a 24-bit version? Can we have it, or can we pay for it, or just send it to me, it's mine. Which is, I suspect, the likely outcome.
That's the likely one, yeah.
They're going to go to somewhere else, some back street, not actually back street, but some remasterer who's cheap. And then they'll actually say, oh, do me some 9624 files, you know, of this. Or of whatever it is, you know, yeah. Whatever it is. They'll, you know, offer 44K 24-bit master, you know, remaster it for me as cheaply as possible so I can sell it in high quality. So we'll have this paradox that... You know, we've spent all this time doing the definitive first master, and then, you know, I'm somewhat concerned, you know, about whether people will actually get what they want. Francis, you have
this,
a question.
I mean, this is already happening. I mean, there are some niche record companies that are selling high resolution masters on the internet as downloads in flat files or what have you. And when they're made available, a couple of companies have said that they outsell the conventional resolution versions by quite a substantial proportion compared with the conventional CD quality or MP3 or what have you. And it's certain sort of, what you might get, some Lin Records, Blue Coast Records in the US, these sort of acoustic recording, high quality niche labels that have a sort of through link to the to their customers, who the people they know who want to buy good quality stuff. But it's very interesting that those particular niche companies have found that they sell more, they charge more for them, but they also sell more of them.
But it's interesting, so most of them as well, you know, I know iTunes now runs without DRM, digital rights management, but for the most part, most of those labels ran with no digital rights management. It was all done on the honesty principle that if you pay for it, you know, please don't share it. And it was largely it is largely successful as well on that basis that they're not...
They seem to have given up their sort of qualms about giving away the original studio master, if you like, well, giving it away, selling it for a premium.
Yeah.
And not copy protected.
Yes.
I think there's another issue here, though, that, but to this to go forward as well, I mean... We still have this lack of embedded data or metadata associated with the file. At the moment, it's very hard. I know some of the people that I've worked with on some of the specialist downloads where we're selling high res, and I've been talking to them to be able to provide the purchaser with all the right information, data, all the information you'd find normally on the back of the sleeve, maybe the photo from the front of the sleeve, all this sort of thing, all this, the part of the package, we still haven't got the package right. We may be able to sell the file, but how do we sell the whole package? And that really hasn't been addressed there.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting that quite a lot of people who buy these things don't realise that they're actually playing them back, probably down-sampled or not at 96 kilohertz, because their sound card won't cope with it. Or they play it back on the line.
And I think there's going to be a big confusion as well, because you know, they may sell the WAVs, they may sell an AIF, they may promote FLAC, they may promote some other lossless system, and I think it's just going to get so confusing. They're going to have so many file formats out there, and discerning the difference in quality between them. I mean, I've been testing some lossless file systems, and I'm not convinced by some of them.
Are you not?
No.
FLAC? Well, it's either
lossless. I didn't say FLAC. I didn't say any file format.
Have you tested FLAC? Have you tested FLAC
file? I haven't lossless. Seriously tested FLAC, I must admit.
There is a. They seem to be lossless.
I know they're supposed to be very, very good, but I have been working on some. I can't say anything, but I've been working on some things where I'm not convinced.
I did ask Daniel Rice, who most of us know about 3 years ago at AES, if he thought that the future of higher quality than CD would be on downloads, because the industry has managed to shoot itself in the foot with SACD in Europe and DVD audio in America, as usual. And he said yes, he could see that the variety of formats would at least mean software duplication, but it wouldn't suffer from the problems of different hardware systems and the confusion that inevitably turns the buyer off. So perhaps we should stop thinking of a hard product for
hard product. Quite possibly. I mean, just go back to this lossless thing as well, just to qualify. When I say I'm not convinced, there's a lot of issues about how you actually compare like-for-like files and how you actually do your listening tests, the listening environment, what you play on, the way equipment's set up and everything else. So please take my comments with a... There's a lot of qualifications to be made, so that's why I wouldn't name any particular products. It's not that, it's just maybe the way it's actually delivered.
It seems a bit arbitrary to me, though, to be selling CD or music to people on 24-bit when 16-bit it has the dynamic range that's plenty capable of handling these things that are crushed to hell anyway. You know, I think 8-bit would actually be able to do it with my impression.
Well, I don't know. I mean, on the few jobs that maybe I've done where I've smashed them to pieces, I can still just about usually discern some difference at the end of the day between the 16 and the 24. But I know where you're coming from. It would be nice if we didn't have to do that.
Yeah, I must admit, I've heard Stan Lipschitz play some 8-bit recordings he's made just for the fun of it that put an awful lot of 16-bit and 24-bit recordings to shame. If it's done correctly, you know, that's linear recording. And if you get into the non-linear world, there are some other things. Mr. Young.
There has been quite a lot of work done in the last couple of years on distributing high-resolution audio on Blu-ray disc, which is a way of breaking free of the limitations of the CD and having a predictable set of replay codecs, linear replay codecs. Is that something? Oh, it also breaks free of some of the loudness restrictions that the CDs imposed, because you don't need to use the dynamic range in that way.
Yes.
Is that an avenue you would see opening up?
I'd like to see it opening up.
You can't see it though.
The problem is trying to get the... It goes back to that thing of the dual inventory again with the record label. The people who hold most of this media in the first place are reluctant to see multiple formats out there, multiple inventory items. if somebody else wants to come along and pay for it, they seem to be, they warm to that idea. Which is what promoted.
There does, in some circumstances, tend to be a premium for good quality distribution.
Yes.
If medium is stable.
I agree. I'd love to see it proceed as well. The thing about the Pure Audio Blu-ray disc as well is that on that disc you have a download area. From the Ethernet output of your Blu-ray player, you've effectively can access a web browser, which will allow you to download files off the disc, because the Blu-ray itself is technically, legally, not rippable. They put on there, you know, a set of files, whether they're MP3s or 4416 files, so that you have actually got other things that you can put on a different portable thing, like that, you know, let's say your iPod. That also opens up the thing, the prospect, because there's an awful lot of spare space there, that you can actually put down two versions, one that's got dynamic range and one that's slammed, so if you put it on shuffle with Metallica, you might actually hear it, you know, let's say. I see it has great potential. Unfortunately, trying to get the people who hold most of the media to unlock the libraries and put up a perhaps modest amount of money to go forward with it, is not proving easy.
I think we also find there's a problem now that even just getting third party people to, let's say there was an artist and you run a record company, you want to license some material from a major company and reissue it as a Blu-ray or a DVD-A or an SACD. There seems to be a reluctance on some of the majors now to actually let that happen. They want to be able to, you know, it's like with vinyl reissues and things like that, they're trying to bring all this in-house again as their whole business model changes. They're tending to be precious with that product and won't let it out. And the cost implications, I don't see it developing.
Yeah, it'd be nice. But, you know, as I said, going back to the previous point, you know, should Apple suddenly, start saying, well, we'll do 44, 24-bit downloads, or even 96, 24. After all, when iTunes Music Store started, you couldn't at that point in history buy, I believe, a Sony release as a download except directly from Sony. And you could buy a CD single you could buy the title track of the CD single for more money than the CD single actually copied in A-track compression that you could only play on a Sony device. So it was not really a great package at a great price. And one of the things iTunes Music Store did actually do was bring together the whole marketplace into one store. It may just be that what's actually in the back of their minds is possibly to bring all of the 96K 24-bit material that's like at Name Records and any of the other places, that esoteric labels and the McCartney stuff and some of the Peter Gabriel stuff, to bring it all into one place on a worldwide platform. And that, of course, might take that very small but tangible marketplace and expose it to a much bigger audience, which, even if it just multiplies that by 10, the marketplace, that would be it. That'd be a substantial increase for all these people. The worry is, of course, that, you know, if it could get blown out of the water if suddenly just everyone starts just sampling a 4416 CD to 9624 and going, that'll do then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's already happening, isn't it? I mean, some of the remasters that I've done some work studying remastering. I was in touch with a guy in Denmark. He sent me a remaster, I can't remember the name of the band now, he told me they were the Danish equivalent of Joy Division. But the remaster had been done from vinyl. And in fact, actually, I did a little bit of working out, because the remaster was running quicker, substantially quicker, hand pitched up than the original. And I worked out that it must have been, maybe it was the right way around, I think it was recorded at 48K and probably then spun back out to 44.1. I did a little bit of did some analysis, picked out some key frequencies and worked out that in fact that was pretty much exactly what must have happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm hearing now that some remasters are being done from MP3s. I mean, you know, some of the remasters that come out, they say reassuringly, some of them on the back, remastered for superior sound quality, but I've only been convinced by one lot of remasters so far, and those are the mono Beatles ones that I've heard, which actually do sound very good. Some of them I've heard are absolutely shocking.
Turn that on its head. I just had to, Sean, about this, I think I just had to cut a record that someone brought to me as a digital file, and we cut the record 7-inch 45 because so late to the client, who I know well, rang up and said, it's cut the wrong speed. And I said, no, the way the lathe works, no. But we had to prove our point. We went out, we bought an expensive strobe, and without going into all the different histories, we were sure our turntable, cutting the turntable, was spot on. And this company has got 3 or 4 turntables. So I give them the due. They went out and bought the same expensive strobe, which is about £300 or £400, and only one of their record players was actually running at the right speed. And that was a Vestax.
Well, on that quality note, I think we should draw this to a close, because we're running out of time. Thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank Ray Starr, David Woolley, Mazen Murad for assisting on this evening. And I'd like to thank you all for coming and raising some good questions along the way. Thank you very much.